Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Rituparna Padkiri. Today, I'm going to be in conversation with Rachna Darius-Nicholson. Dr. Rachna Darius-Nicholson is an assistant professor of theater studies at the University of Hong Kong. She is Barbro Klein Fellow at the Swedish Collegium for Advanced Study and Luce East Asia Fellow at the National Humanities Center in 2021-22. She is the author of articles and book chapters in Theater Research International, Theater Survey, The Drama Review, TDR, South Asia, Journal of South Asian Studies, The Rutledge Companion to Theatre and Performance Historiography, and the Mithun Drama Handbook of Theatre History and Historiography. She was the convener of the IFTR Historiography Working Group between 2017 and 20. She is the author of the book, The Colonial Public and the Parsi Stage, The Making of the Theatre of Empire, 1853 to 1893, published by Palgrave in 2021, which will be the focus of our conversation today. I'm very glad to have you with us. Welcome to this interview.
Thank you, Rituparna. It's great to be here.
Right. So let's begin by knowing a little bit about your inspiration behind writing this book in terms of the factors that motivated you to, you know, take up writing this manuscript.
So the journey for this book began, you know, a very long time ago, more than a decade ago, when I was an MA student at the University of Copenhagen. I was doing something very, very far removed from South Asian studies or even theater history. I was actually training to become a theater practitioner. So, you know, we were doing voice training and we were doing dramaturgy and we were doing workshops. And during that time, you know, that one sort of pivotal thing happened. A few pivotal things happened, which I won't get into, but one of them was perusing the shelves of the theater library at the University of Copenhagen and chancing upon a book called The Parsi Theater, Its Origins and Development by Somnath Gupt, translated by Catherine Hansen. And I was very surprised to see that book, I remember, and seeing the title, because having grown up in Bombay, I knew what Parsi theater was. I mean, I had this impression of Parsi theater as being this quaint theater form for the Parsis of Bombay that happens once a year on the Parsi New Year, the Zoroastrian New Year. And so I was very surprised to read about this enormously influential cultural phenomenon in the 19th century that was not only the precursor to, you know, numerous modern proscenium-based theaters across South Asia and Southeast Asia, but also the predecessor of Bollywood. And so, you know, I was shocked to read of that because, you know, being half Parsi myself, I found it incredible that I had no idea about this hugely important cultural phenomenon, arguably the most important cultural phenomenon in the subcontinent in the 19th century. So I decided that after completing my MA, you know, one of the things that I found frustrating about the book was the paucity of primary sources that were referred to in the book. It was very interesting, but, you know, the book primarily relied on secondary sources, and, you know, you couldn't get a very good sense of which troops existed when or how the theater evolved from one genre to another, who would, you know, which playwrights came when, what plays exactly they wrote and what these plays were about. You know, all of the details essentially were missing. And so I thought that after my master's, I would go back to India and see if I could find any primary sources. And so I did what every self-respecting scholar does, which is I went to Google and I typed Parsi theater scripts. This was in 2009-10. This institution popped up, UNESCO Parzor in New Delhi. And so I wrote an email to the head of that institute. And then I found myself in Delhi a few weeks later. And there were 100 or so Parsi theater scripts dating from the 19th century in that archive. At the time, I was unable to read Gujarati. I understood it passively because that was the language that my parents spoke at home. And that is the language, one of the languages that you hear quite often in Bombay, which is where I grew up. But I didn't know how to read the language. And so that was the beginning of a tortuous year-long process of sitting with my mother every evening and having her read these scripts to me while I would record her voice and then read the text with her. And we both essentially were not only discovering a new language, which is 19th century Parsi Gujarati, which, you know, there is a version of that that exists today, but it is essentially a dead language. So we were not only discovering that, but, you know, my mother was essentially enacting these plays for me. So it was almost a sense of, you know, these plays were almost brought to life in a way during that time, during that year. And then I also decided during that time that the easiest way to really do this research properly is to do a PhD. So I actually got into academia for all the wrong reasons, I would say, not to, you know, get into an academic career, but to be able to do this project properly. And so I ended up again in Munich in 2012 to sort of trace this 100-year-long cultural phenomenon. And the first thing that one of my supervisors said when I got to Munich, you know, after having found these 100 years worth of play scripts, was that, you know, you actually don't have enough archival materials. You need to go back to India and you need to find newspapers that are chronicling this theatrical form, so vernacular newspapers. And so I went back to Bombay, and that's exactly what I did. I found 100 years worth of newspapers that have hardly been looked at. The Rast Goftar, which was published from 1853 onwards, and the Jame Jamshed and the Bombay Samachar. The Bombay Samachar being the oldest vernacular newspaper in India. And so that was sort of the beginning of this very long journey that I embarked on. I magical journey, because I spent many, many hot, sweaty, but beautiful months at the J.N. Pettit Library in Bombay, which is an incredible archive of resources on South Asia that few people actually explore, turning page after page of these relatively untouched newspapers from the 19th century in Gujarati that essentially told the story not only of the genesis and the development of this theater, but also of the Parsi community's response to the theater's origins and subsequent development. So that is essentially how the book came about. It comes from, you know, even though it's about a 100-year cultural phenomenon, it's very much rooted in a particular place, which is Bombay. And it is heavily based on archival resources in Parsi, Gujarati, and Urdu from Bombay. So that is how the book came about, I would say.
Thank you for the very comprehensive overview. Next, if you could talk a little bit about who the Parsis are and what their significance in the Indian context has been for our listeners all over the world, that would be really great.
Mm-hmm. So the Parsi community, the bog standard answer is that they're an ethno-religious minority from Iran, from Persia. They fled from Persia about 1,000 years ago with the Islamic invasion of Persia, and they settled on the western coast of Gujarat. And they were essentially primarily engaged in agriculture and artisanry. But the Parsi community very much flourished with the advent of British colonialism. So prior to the British landing in India, you know, they lived very much on the periphery of the Indian subcontinent. They kept to themselves. There's a very famous story of, the sugar in the milk, where the Parsis tell the Gujarati ruler that, you know, when they first come to India, that they will sort of sweeten the milk, just like the sugar sweetens the milk. They will also sweeten India and, you know, absorb into Indian culture. But they sort of, one of the rules, you know, one of the legends is that they promised the ruler that they would not try to proselytize the community to their religion, which is Zoroastrianism. And that they would keep to themselves, you know, they would marry within the community and so on and so forth. The Parsi community is very easily identifiable. they look a certain way, they talk a certain way, they act a certain way. And in the 19th century, you know, they were the chief compradors, or one of the most important comprador communities for the British. The word comprador is a Portuguese word which means middlemen. So they essentially facilitated or made possible the British opium and cotton trade. They essentially made possible the project of empire. So if you even look at Parsi surnames today, such as Dubash or Dalal. Dubash means two languages or translator, and Dalal means broker or trader. These surnames essentially reference the community's very important compradorial role for the British in the 18th and 19th century. So whether it was building ships or providing provisions to the British troops, you know, trading in alcohol, translating, finding labor, you know, for the British. All of this was essentially done by the Parsis. And then subsequently, you know, they amassed a considerable amount of wealth by engaging in their own shipping and trading ventures. So a very famous name is Jamsetji Jiji Boy. He engaged in the opium trade with Jardine and Matheson, which should be a name that history buffs should be familiar with. And so the Parsis were heavily engaged in the opium and cotton trade in the 19th century. And that's what led to them being a very rich community. They are a very tiny community in India today, but a very wealthy community. So if you walk around South Bombay, you'll see that a lot of the monuments in South Bombay, a lot of the fountains, a lot of the old 19th century buildings were constructed by the Parsi millionaires of the 19th century.
Right. So could you also talk a little bit about how the process of colonialism impacted the development of Parsi theatre?
So the Parsi theatre couldn't really have happened without colonialism. The theatre started in 1853, and it was very much inspired by two phenomena. The first were travelling European companies that had begun stopping in Bombay and performing at the town hall. And so the young Parsi thespians who had begun attending school and university were very much inspired by these traveling companies. And so one of the key inspirations for the Parsi theatre for its earliest plays were these traveling troupes. The second is actually the Marathi theater. The Marathi theater was the first theater in Western India to begin performing these plays that were based on a script with a proscenium stage. The Parsi theater was very much inspired by these two forms. Colonialism, I would say, made possible in very sort of practical, material ways the theater. The Parsi theater was the largest, most influential proscenium-based theater in the Indian subcontinent in the 19th century. And so all of the mechanical devices, the visual effects that were traveling during that period from Australia to South Africa to Europe, they made all of these things came to India, to Bombay, and the Parsi theater was very much an indigenous response to all of these things. So yes, and I mean, I don't want to delve into the sort of the nitty gritties of the book, but the book also tells the story of how the theater was also very much a response. It came out of the Parsi reformist movement, the social reform movement of the Parsi community, which essentially was a very broad phenomenon that was happening among diverse communities in India, whether it was the Hindus or the Muslims, and all these communities were essentially trying to reform their religious and social practices. So whether it was child marriage or dowries or even wearing appropriate clothing, every community was trying to adopt English standards of morality and virtue. Or civilization and progress. And the Parsi theater was also a part of that movement. There was an attempt on the part of the Parsis. It was an attempt on the part of the Parsis to, I would say, not just appropriate, but adapt to, I think, some of the morals or sort of values, I think, of the ruling class. Yes.
Right. So could you also talk a little bit about the relationship that the Parsis shared with, the idea of the public sphere? Because that era is important when we look at that concept. And Habermas talks about the development of a public sphere in Europe. And how does it, shape their relationship in the Indian context?
Mm-hmm. One of the key sort of stories of the book is tracing how the evolution of the public sphere in the subcontinent, and showing how the public sphere in the subcontinent operated quite differently from the one in the European context. If I have to talk about the beginnings quite specifically, the first vernacular newspaper in India, which is, the Bombay Samachar, it started off not as a newspaper, but to communicate news more quickly among the Parsi traders. So, it was faster than government postage. And so it started off simply to convey market rates more quickly amongst the traders. But then, something quite pivotal happened, which was this missionary, John Wilson, who actually created this very important university college in Bombay called the Wilson College. He began attacking the Parsis in the Bombay Samachar around the 1830s for their allegedly impure customs and beliefs, and telling them that they were a polytheistic religion and how they worship the elements, and how the religion was full of inaccuracies and was all, mumbo jumbo, and essentially trying to convert the Parsis. The editor of the Bombay Samachar at the time was completely inequipped to deal with this Gujarati-speaking missionary who seemingly knew more about Zoroastrianism than the Parsis did. And that led to the Parsi social reform movement. So other young Parsis began responding in the newspaper, you know, attacking the Parsi priestly class and also the community's leaders for not being able to respond to Wilson's criticisms. And that led to a broad sweeping questioning of the Parsi's religious and social customs, leading to numerous vernacular newspapers. One of these newspapers was the Rast Goftar, which, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the copies are lying at the J.N. Pettit Institute. And I would say they're the most important newspapers that exist to date if one needs to understand what was happening in Western India and in Bombay specifically. The Rast Goftar, you know, became the mouthpiece of the Parsi social reform movement. So every week, articles would be published on themes such as the evils of gambling, the need for moral amusement and libraries and exhibitions, how, you know, women should not wail at funerals, how wedding expenses should be kept at a minimum, you know, or even, you know, the need for learning about the religion on Western lines. So talking about the works of people like Max Müller and the German Orientalists. All of this was part of the social reform movement. And the theater, as I mentioned, comes out of the social reform movement. So the same people that created the newspaper, the Rast Goftar, and the same people who were also part of the Bombay Association, which is the place that germinated the Indian National Congress, the political movement, the key pro-independence movement of India. That same the people from that association also created the Parsi Theatre for the same reasons, which was the social and moral improvement of the Parsi community of Bombay.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So just to get a sense of, you know, the gendered perspective, how do you understand the role of women in all of this? Because you do focus on it in your book. And do you think that Parsi theater managed to create an essentialist idea of, you know, an indigenous or an Indian femininity?
So it's not a coincidence that the picture on the cover of the book is of a woman. It's not a woman. It's actually a girl. It's an unnamed female, I don't even want to say actress, but performer. From the late 19th century, who performed for a very, very important Parsi theatre company, the Baliwala company. But women, you know, I mean, the book is essentially not just about the Parsi theatre, it's also about the place of women in the public sphere in the 19th century and early 20th century. The book shows how, again, it's very hard to sort of gloss over this in a few minutes, the first chapter essentially shows how women were actually central to the Parsi social reform movement. So, you know, the entire you know, I would say that the culmination of the reform movement was the consolidation of Parsi law in the 19th century. And women were at the center, the rights of women were at the center of the drafting of Parsi law in sort of during that period. But, you know, if you, other scholars have written about this and have shown this better than I have. But, you know, even though rights were seemingly being conferred on Parsi women, these rights, you know, they may not have effectively been actually materially changing, I think, women's ability to be able to say, you know, do certain things freely in public. So, for example, the book shows how, you know, the Parsi theater opened up a space for respectable, moral women to come into the public sphere and attend the theater. But at the same time, it did so by castigating Nach women. So pre-colonial theater forms or entertainment forms. So there was a very strong attempt to contrast respectable, moral, pure Parsi women from the crass women of the street. And so there was this paradoxical thing happening in the mid-19th century, which was that while ostensibly certain rights were being given to certain class of women, many other women were being ostracized at the same time. Subsequently, the book shows how, you know, in a few years later, just, you know, a decade later, the theater moves from being a cultural phenomenon for the Parsi community of Bombay to this mass theatrical form for the subcontinent, essentially, and for South Asia and for Southeast Asia. And so it ceases to be for the moral benefit of the Parsi community. It becomes and chiefly a form of amusement and entertainment. And that's when you see actually these Nach women returning to the stage. You know, that's also when you see the moral respectable classes ceasing to attend the theater. And that's also when you begin to see a very interesting phenomenon happening, which is within the plays themselves, you begin to see a plethora of female characters. First, you see, you know, the first play in Hindustani of the Parsi theater, which is Sona Mulni Khurshid. Khurshid is a female character who is essentially kidnapped by many, many men, and she manages to retain her chastity throughout. But it's a very important and potent allegory that was being performed in the 19th century of the indigenous woman who had been captured by many men, but who had never lost her purity. And that trope subsequently transforms in a few years into Hindu mythological figures. So figures like Sita and Damayanti, these very marked Hindu characters that then become the symbols for the Indian nationalist movement and for Hindu revivalism. So the theater, you know, the woman's question in the Parsi theater was never a simple one. You know, on the one hand, the theater had a very complex relationship with women inside of the theater, so with actresses and with female patrons, but it also had a very complex relationship with the way female characters were represented on stage. And I argue in the book, I show how the theater was essentially the most important mechanism for disseminating popular visions of nationalism through these female characters.
Right. Again, very fascinating. And I would also want to know, since you talk about, you know, the relationship with colonialism, do you think that Parsi theater became a big part of the British Empire and, you know, its influential cultural commodity part in this period?
So the book traces how the Parsi theatre evolved from being a theatrical form, an amateur theatrical form for the Parsi community of Bombay, to becoming this hugely, enormously influential cultural commodity of the 19th century that traveled from Bombay to then North India, South India, and then further afield to Burma and Singapore and present-day Indonesia and Java and even East Africa, and subsequently to London. Where it was not very successful, but the Parsi theater was enormously successful in Southeast Asia and East Asia, and in fact, it led to the emergence of proscenium-based theaters in all of these parts of the world. So if you think of Bangsawan or the Comedy Istanbul, all of these forms, the Nurti, they were essentially inspired by the Parsi theater. So yes, the Parsi theater was enormously influential during that period.
Right. So just to know a little bit more and, explore the relationship between Parsi theatre and cinema, because you call it a precursor to how cinema began in India. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
So the book stops at 1893 just because, I was getting really, I had reached the 700 page mark with my thesis. And that was when my supervisor wisely said, I wrote to him saying, should I stop now? And he said, yes. But the theater phenomenon, it goes on. It 1893 is the halfway mark of the theater. It actually, of the pre-colonial, I have to say, of the colonial Parsi theater. It's also the year, 1893 is also the year that marks the advent of cinema in the Indian subcontinent and film. And the second part of the book, which is still to be written, but which is very much on my mind. I mean, I don't know when it'll be written, maybe in 10, 20 years, I don't know. But I mean, I have the material, but in the second part, you can see how the sources show how the theater subsequently tries to negotiate its very precarious position, not only in relation to the Indian nationalist movement, but also in relation to the rise of this new technology, which is film. Everyone who knows about, Indian theater history knows that all of the key personnel of the early Indian cinema of Bollywood came from the Parsi theater, and all of the scenography, the spectacular devices, just the entire visual scheme of early Indian cinema comes from the Parsi theater. The ways of acting, the ways of singing and dancing, all of that is drawn from Parsi theater tradition. So there's a direct link. I wouldn't even say link. It's sort of a very seamless line between the early 20th century Parsi theater and Bollywood. I think one of the key arguments of the text is also that it's very difficult to speak of one single Parsi theater. I mean, there was the mainstream Hindustani theater that became Bollywood, but there was also Parsi theater happening in Gujarati for the Parsi community of Bombay. There were, specific Parsi theaters happening in Rajasthan, in Tamil Nadu, in Tamil, as I mentioned earlier, in sort of Southeast Asia, in Java. These different forms that were happening for specific communities also evolved during that period. The example that I always cite is the Parsi theater for the Parsi community. It subsequently became, the Parsi theater that we know it today, which is something that happens once or twice a year for the Parsi community in Gujarati during festival days, so during the Persian New Year, Navroz. I guess that's the interesting thing about sort of this theatrical form, that on the one hand, it led to this, to Bollywood. Bollywood is very much a part of that lineage, but it also, you can see the influence of this form in many other less apparent places, like, you know, on Navroz Day Parsi celebrations or in the Bang Sawan.
Right. So just to end the interview, if you, you know, would want to talk about future scope of research in this area and, you know, what kind of research can be picked up, because your manuscript is very recent. It just got published in 2021.
So, I mean, one of the key arguments of the text is that history is always written from a particular place. And I have very consciously written this book from the place of Bombay and the point of view of the Parsi community of Bombay. And one of the claims that the book makes is that it's impossible to write a history of more than 100-year-old theatrical phenomenon that spread from Bombay to all over the subcontinent and then to Southeast Asia and East Asia and East Africa. You know, it's impossible to write about such a huge, thick cultural form in one book and by one person. You know, if one had to write the authoritative history of the Parsi theater, one would need to access sources, not just in Gujarati and Hindustani, but in the numerous minor sort of languages that the theater subsequently was also performed in. While I have written the story of the origins of the Parsi theater, you know, and very much sort of based on heavily on Parsi Gujarati and Hindustani sources, I think there's enormous scope for other researchers to write, you know, the version of the Parsi theater, the history of the Parsi theater from other places, from other locations, whether that's Rajasthan or whether that's Lucknow or whether that's Madras or Burma. I think there's enormous scope for, I think, you know, I think what I've done is sort of essentially provide a starting conceptual map that would allow, I think, other researchers to know sort of the details, like this is when a Parsi theater troupe traveled to Burma in this year and this month, or this is the year that a troupe traveled to Calcutta or Delhi. And I think, you know, like I said, I think there's enormous scope for then a researcher in Delhi or Calcutta to, you know, look at sort of the Bengali, for example, newspapers in that year and then see the local impact of the theater in those places. So I would say there's huge, huge scope, I think, for further work in this field. And, you know, this is also, this leads to another question, which is on sort of the privileging of particular kinds of archival resources over others. You know, one of the great advantages about the digitization of newspapers like the Times of India is that you can write, you know, Parsi theater, and with a click you can get 150 entries on the Parsi theater, and you can sort of kind of see what's happening. But at the same time, that kind of research is very superficial. You know, you see a very partial English elitist view of the theater. You actually don't get to see what's happening on the ground. And I think, you know, if the kind of research that I hope will subsequently come out on this form, you know, will engage with the local vernacular, unprivileged sources, the ones in local languages that are not digitized and that are potentially rotting away in community or local archives, and that are not valued as much as, say, sources in English or in Hindi or Urdu. I think those are the sources that I hope will be looked at in the future, and that eventually leads to the kind of research, a kind of decentering of Hindi and Hindustani and English that I just hope that that's the kind of research that will happen in the future.
Right. Thank you so much for the very fun and engaging conversation. And I hope that our listeners do pick up the book and read it. Thank you once again for taking the time out for New Books in Sociology.
Thank you, Rituparna. Thank you.